themselves. It was to be a long, long march through the dust all that day and the next. We would stop once every hour for a few minutes and would ride on until dusk before making camp near a village and always by a stream or a river. They cared for us well on that march, often dismounting and walking beside us to give us the rest we needed. But sweetest of all were the full buckets of cooling, quenching water they would bring us whenever we stopped beside a stream. Topthorn, I noticed, always shook his head in the water before he started to drink so that alongside him I was showered all over my face and neck with cooling water. The mounts were tethered in horse lines out in the open as we had been on manoeuvres back in England, so we were already hardened to living out. But it was colder now as the damp mists of autumn fell each evening and chilled us where we stood. We had plenty of fodder morning and evening, a generous ration of corn from our nose bags, and we grazed whenever we could. Like the men, we had to learn to live off the land as much as possible. Every hour of the march brought us nearer the distant thunder of the guns, and at night now the horizon would be bright with orange flashes from one end to the other. I had heard the crack of rifle fire before back at the barracks, and this had not upset me one bit, but the growling crescendo of the big guns sent tremors of fear along my back and broke my sleep into a succession of jagged nightmares. But whenever I woke, dragged back to consciousness by the guns, I found Topthorn was always by me and would breathe his courage into me to support me. It was a slow baptism of fire for me, but without Topthorn, I think I should never have become accustomed to the guns, for the fury and the violence of the thunder as we came ever nearer to the front line seemed to sap my strength as well as my spirits. On the march, Topthorn and I walked always together, side by side, for Captain Nichols and Captain Stewart were rarely apart. They seemed somehow separate in spirit from their heartier fellow officers. The more I got to know Captain Nichols, the more I liked him. He rode me as Albert had, with a gentle hand and a firm grip of the knees, so that, despite his size, and he was a big man, he was always light on me. And there was always some warm word of encouragement or gratitude after a long ride. This was a welcome contrast to Corporal Samuel Perkins, who had ridden me so hard whilst in training. I caught sight of him from time to time and pitied the horse he rode. Captain Nichols did not sing or whistle as Albert had, but he talked to me from time to time when we were alone together. No one, it appeared, really knew where the enemy was. That he was advancing and that we were retreating was not in doubt. We were supposed to try to ensure that the enemy did not outflank us. We did not want the enemy to get between us and the sea and turn the flank of the whole British expeditionary force. But the squadron had first to find the enemy, and they were never anywhere to be seen. We scoured the countryside for days before finally blundering into them, and that was a day I shall never forget. The day of our first battle. Rumour rippled back along the column that the enemy had been sighted, a battalion of infantry on the march. They were out in the open a mile or so away, hidden from us by a long copse of oaks that ran alongside the road. The orders rang out. Forward! Form! Squadron column! Draw swords! As one, the men reached down and grasped their swords from their sheaths, and the air flickered with bright steel before the blades settled on the troopers' shoulders. Squadron! Right shoulder! Came the command, and we walked in line abreast into the wood. I felt Captain Nichols's knees close tight around me, and he loosened the reins. His body was taut, and for the first time he felt heavy on my back. Easy, Joey, he said softly. Easy now, don't get excited. We'll come out of this all right, don't you worry. I turned to look at Topthorn, who was already up on his toes, ready for the trot that we knew was to come. I moved instinctively closer to him, and then, as the bugle sounded, we charged out of the shade of the wood and into the sunlight of battle. The gentle squeak of leather, the jingling harness, and the noise of hastily barked orders were drowned now by the pounding of hooves and the shout of the troopers as we galloped down on the enemy in the valley below us. Out of the corner of my eye, I was aware of the glint of Captain Nichols's heavy sword. I felt his spurs in my side, and I heard his battle cry. I saw the grey soldiers ahead of us raise their rifles and heard the death rattle of a machine gun. And then quite suddenly I found that I had no rider and I had no weight on my back anymore, and I was alone out in front of the squadron. Topthorn was no longer beside me, but with horses behind me I knew there was only one way to gallop, and that was forward. Blind, Terror drove me on, with my flying stirrups whipping me into a frenzy. With no rider to carry, I reached the kneeling riflemen first, and they scattered as I came upon them. I ran on, until I found myself alone and away from the noise of the battle, and I would never have stopped at all had I not found Topthorne once more beside me, with Captain Stewart leaning over to gather up my reins before leading me back to the battlefield. "We had won," I heard it said. But horses lay dead and dying everywhere. More than a quarter of the squadron had been lost in that one action. It had all been so quick and so deadly. A cluster of grey-uniformed prisoners had been taken, and they huddled together now under the trees whilst the squadron regrouped and exchanged extravagant reminiscences of a victory that had happened almost by accident rather than by design. I never saw Captain Nichols again, and that was a great and terrible sadness for me, for he had been a kind and gentle man, and had cared for me well as he had promised. As I was to learn, there were few enough such good men in the world. "You'd have been proud of you, Joey," said Captain Stewart, as he led me back to the horse lines with Topthorne. "You'd have been proud of you the way you kept going out there. He died leading that charge, and you finished it for him. He'd have been proud of you." Topthorne stood over me that night as we bivouacked on the edge of the woods. We looked out together over the moonlit valley, and I longed for home. Only the occasional coughing and stamping of the sentries broke the still of the night. The guns were silent at last. Topthorne sank down beside me, and we slept. Chapter 7. It was just after Reveille the next morning, and we were rummaging around in our nosebags for the last of our oats, when I saw Captain Jamie Stewart striding along the horse lines towards us. Behind him, swamped in a vast greatcoat and peaked cap, trailed a young trooper I had never seen before. He was pink-faced and young under his hat, and reminded me at once of Albert. I sensed that he was nervous of me, for his approach was hesitant and reluctant. Captain Stewart felt Topthorne's ears and stroked his soft muzzle as he always did first thing in the morning, and then, reaching across, he patted me gently on the neck. "Well, Trooper Warren, here he is," said Captain Stewart. "Come closer, Trooper, he won't bite. This is Joey. This horse belonged to the best friend I ever had, so you look after him. Do you hear?" His tone was firm, but not unsympathetic. "And Trooper, I shall be able to keep my eye on you all the time, because these two horses are inseparable. They're the best two horses in the squadron, and they know it." He stepped closer to me and lifted my forelock clear of my face. "Joey," he whispered, "you take care of him. He's only a little lad, and he's had a rough ride in this war so far." So when the squadron moved out of the wood that morning, I found I could no longer walk alongside Topthorne, as I had before with Captain Nichols, but was now just one of the troop following behind the officers in a long column of troopers. But whenever we stopped to feed or drink, Trooper Warren was careful to walk me over to where Topthorne stood so we could be together. Trooper Warren was not a good horseman. I could tell that the minute he mounted me. He was always tense and rode me heavy in the saddle like a sack of potatoes. He had neither the experience and confidence of Corporal Samuel Perkins, nor the finesse and sensitivity of Captain Nichols. He rocked unevenly in the saddle and rode me always on too tight a rein, so that I was forced to toss my head continuously to loosen it. But once out of the saddle, he was the gentlest of men. He was meticulous and kind in his grooming, and attended at once to my frequent and painful saddle sores, chafings and wind galls, to which I was particularly prone. He cared for me as no one had since I left home. Over the next few months, it was his loving attention that was to keep me alive. There were a few minor skirmishes during that first autumn of the war, but as Captain Nichols had predicted, we were used less and less as cavalry and more as transport for mounted infantry. Whenever we came across the enemy, the squadron would dismount, drawing their rifles from their buckets, and the horses would be left behind out of sight under the care of a few troopers, so that we never saw any of the action ourselves, but heard the distant crackle of rifle fire and the rattle of machine guns. When the troop returned and the squadron moved off again, there were always one or two horses without riders. We would be on the march for hours and days on end, it seemed. Then suddenly a motorcycle would roar past us through the dust, and there would be the barked commands and the shrill call of the bugles, and the squadron would swing off the road and into action once more. It was during these long, stifling marches, and during the cold nights that followed, that Trooper Warren began to talk to me. He told me how, in the same action in which Captain Nichols had been killed, he had had his horse shot down from beneath him, and how, only a few weeks before, he had been an apprentice blacksmith with his father. Then the war had broken out. He did not want to join up, he said, but the squire of the village had spoken to his father, and his father, who rented his house and his smithy from the squire, had no option but to send him off to war, and since he had grown up round horses, he volunteered to join the cavalry. "I tell you, Joey," he said one evening as he was picking out my hooves, "I tell you, I never thought I would get on a horse again after that first battle. Strange thing is, Joey, that it wasn't the shooting. Somehow I didn't mind that. It was just the idea of riding an horse again that terrified the life out of me. Wouldn't think that possible, would you? Not with me being a smithy and all. Still, I'm over it now, and you've done that for me, Joey. Give me back my confidence. Feel I can do anything now. Feel like one of those knights in armour when I'm up on you." Then, with the onset of winter, the rain came down in sheets. It was refreshing at first, and a welcome break from the dust and the flies, but soon the fields and paths turned to mud beneath us. The squadron could no longer bivouac in the dry, for there was little enough shelter, and so both man and horse were constantly soaked to the skin. There was little or no protection from the driving rain, and at night we stood now over our fetlocks in cold, oozing mud. But Trooper Warren looked after me with great devotion, finding shelter for me wherever and whenever he could, rubbing some warmth into me with wisps of dry straw whenever he could find it, and ensuring that I always got a good ration of oats in my nose bag to keep me going. As the weeks passed, his pride in my strength and stamina became obvious to everyone, as did my affection for him. If only, I thought, if only he could just groom me and care for me, and someone else could ride me. My Trooper Warren would talk a great deal about how the war was going. We were, he said, to be withdrawn to reserve camps behind our own lines. The armies, it appeared, had pounded each other to a standstill in the mud and had dug in. The dugouts had soon become trenches, and the trenches had joined each other, zigzagging across the country from the sea to Switzerland. In the spring, he said, we would be needed again to break the deadlock. The cavalry could go where the infantry could not and were fast enough to overrun the trenches. We'd show the infantry how to do it, he said. But there was the winter to survive before the ground became hard enough again for the cavalry to be used effectively. Topthorne and I spent that winter sheltering each other as best we could from the snow and the sleet, whilst only a few miles away we could hear the guns pounding each other day and night incessantly. We saw the cheery soldiers, smiling under their tin hats as they marched off to the front line, whistling and singing and joking as they went, and we watched the remnants struggling back, haggard and silent under their dripping capes in the rain. Every once in a while, Trooper Warren would receive a letter from home, and he would read it out to me in a guarded whisper in case anyone else should overhear. The letters were all from his mother, and they all said much the same thing. "My dear Charlie," he would read, "your father hopes you are well, and so do I. We missed having you with us at Christmas. The table in the kitchen seemed empty without you. But your little brother helps when he can with the work, and Father says he's coming on well even though he's still a bit little and not strong enough yet to hold the farm horses. Minnie Whittle, that old widow from Annaford Farm, died in her sleep last week. She was 80, so she can't grumble at that, though I expect she would if she could. She was always the world's worst grumbler, remember? Well, son, that's about all our news. Your Sally from the village sends her best and says to tell you that she'll be writing soon. Keep safe, dearest boy, and come home soon. Your loving mother." But Sally won't write, Joey, because she can't. Well, not very well anyway. But just as soon as this lot's over and finished, we'll all get back home and marry her. I've grown up with her, Joey. Known her all my life. Suppose I know her almost as well as I know myself, and I like her a lot better. Trooper Warren broke the terrible monotony of that winter. He lifted my spirits, and I could see that Topthorne, too, welcomed every visit he made to the horse lines. He never knew how much good he did us. During that awful winter, so many of the horses went off to the veterinary hospital and never came back. Like all army horses, we were clipped out like hunters, so that all our lower quarters were exposed to the mud and rain. The weaker ones amongst us suffered first, for they had little resilience and went downhill fast. But Topthorne and I came through to the spring, Topthorne surviving a severe cough that shook his whole massive frame as if it was trying to tear the life out of him from the inside. It was Captain Stewart who saved him, feeding him up with a hot mash and covering him as best he could in the bleakest weather. And then, one ice-cold night in early spring, with frost lying on our backs, the troopers came to the horse lines unexpectedly early. It was before dawn. There had been a night of incessant heavy barrage. There was a new bustle and excitement in the camp. This was not one of the routine exercises we had come to expect. The troopers came along the horse lines in full service order. Two bandoliers, respiratory haversack, rifle and sword. We were saddled up and moved silently out of the camp and onto the road. The troopers talked of the battle ahead, and all the frustrations and irritations of imposed idleness vanished as they sang in the saddle. And my Trooper Warren was singing along with them as lustily as any of them. In the cold grey of the night, the squadron joined the regiment in the remnants of a little ruined village, peopled only by cats, and waited there for an hour until the pale light of dawn crept over the horizon. Still the guns bellowed out their fury, and the ground shook beneath us. We passed the field hospitals and the light guns before trotting over the support trenches to catch our first sight of the battlefield. Desolation and destruction were everywhere. Not a building was left intact. Not a blade of grass grew in the torn and ravished soil. The singing around me stopped, and we moved on in ominous silence and out over the trenches that were crammed with men, their bayonets fixed, their rifles. They gave us a sporadic cheer as we clattered over the boards and out into the wilderness of no man's land, into a wilderness of wire and shell holes and the terrible litter of war. Suddenly the guns stopped firing overhead. We were through the wire. The squadron fanned out in a wide, uneven echelon, and the bugle sounded. I felt the spurs biting into my sides and moved up alongside Topthorne as we broke into a trot. "Do me proud, Joey," said Trooper Warren, drawing his sword. "Do me proud." Chapter 8. For just a few short moments, we moved forward at the trot as we had done in training. In the eerie silence of no man's land, all that could be heard was the jingle of the harness and the snorting of the horses. We picked our way around the craters, keeping our line as best we could. Up ahead of us, at the top of a gentle sloping hill, were the battered remnants of a wood, and just below a hideous, rusting roll of barbed wire that stretched out along the horizon as far as the eye could see. "Wire," I heard Trooper Warren whisper through his teeth. "Oh God, Joey, they said the wire would be gone, guns would deal with the wire. Oh my God." We were into a canter now, and still there was no sound nor sight of any enemy. The troopers were shouting at an invisible foe, leaning over their horses' necks, their sabres stretched out in front of them. I galvanized myself into a gallop to keep with Topthorne, and as I did, so the first terrible shells fell amongst us, and the machine guns opened up. The bedlam of battle had begun. All around me men cried and fell to the ground, and horses reared and screamed in an agony of fear and pain. The ground erupted on either side of me, throwing horses and riders clear into the air. The shells whined and roared overhead, and every explosion seemed like an earthquake to us. But the squadron galloped on inexorably through it all towards the wire at the top of the hill, and I went with them. On my back, Trooper Warren held me in an iron grip with his knees. I stumbled once and felt him lose a stirrup, and slowed so that he could find it again. Topthorne was still ahead of me, his head up, his tail whisking from side to side. I found more strength in my legs and charged after him. Trooper Warren prayed aloud as he rode, but his prayers turned soon to curses as he saw the carnage around him. Only a few horses reached the wire, and Topthorne and I were amongst them. There were indeed a few holes blasted through the wire by our bombardment so that some of us could find a way through, and we came at last upon the first line of the enemy trenches, but they were empty. The firing came now from higher up in amongst the trees, and so the squadron, or what was left of it, regrouped and galloped up into the wood, only to be met by a line of hidden wire in amongst the trees. Some of the horses ran into the wire before they could be stopped and stuck there, their riders trying feverishly to extract them. I saw one trooper dismount deliberately once he saw his horse was caught. He pulled out his rifle and shot his mount before falling dead himself on the wire. I could see at once that there was no way through, that the only way was to jump the wire, and when I saw Topthorn and Captain Stewart leap over where the wire was lowest, I followed them and we found ourselves, at last, in amongst the enemy. From behind every tree, from trenches all around it seemed, they ran forward in their piked helmets to counterattack. They rushed past us, ignoring us until we found ourselves surrounded by an entire company of soldiers, their rifles pointing up at us. The crump of the shelling and the spitting of rifle fire had suddenly stopped. I looked around me for the rest of the squadron to discover that we were alone. Behind us, the riderless horses, all that was left of a proud cavalry squadron, galloped back towards our trenches, and the hillside below was strewn with the dead and dying.
"Throw down your sword, trooper,"
said Captain Stewart, bending in his saddle and dropping his sword to the ground.
"There's been enough useless slaughter today. No sense in adding to it."
He walked Topthorn closer towards us and reined in.
"Trooper, I told you once we had the best horses in the squadron, and today they showed us they are the best horses in the entire regiment in the old confounded army, and there's not a scratch on them."
He dismounted as the German soldiers closed in, and Trooper Warren followed suit. They stood side by side, holding our reins while we were surrounded. We looked back down the hill at the battlefield. A few horses were still struggling on the wire, but one by one they were put out of their misery by the advancing German infantry, who had already regained their line of trenches. They were the last shots in the battle.
"What a waste," the captain said. "What a ghastly waste. Maybe now when they see this, they'll understand that you can't send horses into wire and machine guns. Maybe now they'll think again."
The soldiers around us seemed wary of us and kept their distance. They seemed not to know quite what to do with us.
"The horses, sir?" Trooper Warren asked. "Joey and Topthorn, what happens to them now?"
"Same as us, trooper," said Captain Stewart. "They're prisoners of war just as we are."
Flanked by the soldiers who hardly spoke, we were escorted over the brow of a hill and down into the valley below. Here the valley was still green, for there had been no battle over this ground as yet. All the while, Trooper Warren had his arm over my neck to reassure me, and I felt then that he was beginning to say goodbye. He spoke softly into my ear.
"Don't suppose they'll let you come with me where I'm going, Joey? Wish they could, but they can't. But I shan't ever forget you. I promise you that."
"Don't you worry, trooper," Captain Stewart said. "The Germans love their horses every bit as much as we do. They'll be all right. Anyway, Topthorn will look after your Joey. You can be sure of that."
As we came out of the wood and onto the road below, we were halted by our escort. Captain Stewart and Trooper Warren were marched away down the road toward a cluster of ruined buildings that must at one time have been a village, whilst Topthorn and I were led away across the fields and further down the valley. There was no time for long farewells, just a brief last stroke of the muzzle for each of us, and they were gone. As they walked away, Captain Stewart had his arm around Trooper Warren's shoulder.
Chapter 9. We were led away by two nervous soldiers down farm tracks, through orchards and across a bridge before being tied up beside a hospital tent some miles from where we had been captured. A knot of wounded soldiers gathered around us at once. They patted and stroked us, and I began to whisk my tail with impatience. I was hungry and thirsty, and angry that I had been separated from my Trooper Warren. Still no one seemed to know quite what to do with us, until an officer in a long grey coat with a bandage round his head emerged from the tent. He was an immensely tall man, standing a full head higher than anyone around him. The manner of his gait and the way he held himself indicated a man clearly accustomed to wielding authority. A bandage came down over one eye so that he had only half a face visible. As he walked towards us, I saw that he was limping. that one foot was heavily bandaged and that he needed the support of a stick. The soldier sprang back at his approach and stood stiffly to attention. He looked us both over in undisguised admiration, shaking his head and sighing as he did so. Then he turned to the men.
"There are hundreds, like these dead, out on our wire. I tell you, if we had had one jot of the courage of these animals, we should be in Paris by now, not slugging it out here in the mud. These two horses came through hellfire to get here. They were the only two to make it. It was not their fault. They were sent on a fool's errand. They are not circus animals. They are heroes. Do you understand? Heroes. And they should be treated as such. And you stand around and gawp at them. You are none of you badly wounded, and the doctor is far too busy to see you at present. So, I want these horses unsaddled, rubbed down, fed and watered at once. They will need oats and hay, and a blanket for each of them. Now, get moving."
The soldiers hurried away, scattering in all directions, and within a few minutes Topthorne and I were being lavished with all manner of clumsy kindness. None of them had handled a horse before, it seemed, but that did not matter to us, so grateful were we for all the fodder they brought us and the water. We lacked for nothing that morning, and all the time the tall officer supervised from under the trees, leaning on his stick. From time to time he would come up to us and run his hand along our backs and over our quarters, nodding his approval and lecturing his men on the finer points of horse breeding as he examined us. After a time he was joined by a man in a white coat, who emerged from the tent, his hair dishevelled, his face pale with exhaustion. There was blood on his coat.
"Headquarters phones through about the horses, Herr Hauptmann," said the man in white, "and they say I am to keep them for the stretcher cases. I know your views on the matter, Hauptmann, but I am afraid you cannot have them. We need them here desperately, and the way things are going, I fear we will need more. That was just the first attack. There will be more to come. We expect a sustained offensive. It will be a long battle. We are the same on both sides. Once we start something, we seem to have to prove a point, and that takes time and lives. We'll need all the ambulance transport we can get, motorized or horse."
The tall officer drew himself up to his full height and bristled with indignation. He was a formidable sight as he advanced on the man in white.
"Doctor, you cannot put fine British cavalry horses to pulling carts. Any of our horse regiments, my own regiment of lances indeed, would be proud, indeed, overwhelmed to have such splendid creatures in their ranks. You cannot do it, Doctor, I will not permit it."
"Herr Hauptmann," said the doctor patiently. He was clearly not at all intimidated.
"Do you really imagine that after this morning's madness, that either side will be using cavalry again in this war? Can you not understand that we need transport, Herr Hauptmann, and we need it now? There are men, brave men, German and English, lying out there on stretchers in the trenches, and at present there's not enough transport to bring them back to the hospital here. Now, do you want them all to die, Herr Hauptmann? Tell me that. Do you want them to die? If these horses could be hitched up to a cart, they could bring them back in their dozens. We just do not have enough ambulances to cope, and what we do have break down or get stuck in the mud. Please, Herr Hauptmann, we need your help." "The world," said the German officer, shaking his head, "the world has gone quite mad. When noble creatures such as these are forced to become beasts of burden, the world has gone mad. But I can see that you are right. I am a lancer, Herr Doctor, but even I know that men are more important than horses. But you must see to it that you have someone in charge of these two who knows horses. I don't want any dirty-fingered mechanic getting his hands on these two. And you must tell them they are riding horses. They won't take kindly to pulling carts, no matter how noble the cause." "Thank you, Herr Hauptmann," said the doctor. "You are most kind, but I have a problem, Herr Hauptmann.
As I'm sure you will agree, they will need an expert to manage them to start with, particularly if they have never been in a cart before. The problem is that I have only medical orderlies here. True, one of them has worked horses on a farm before the war, but to tell you the truth, Herr Hauptmann, I have no one who could manage these two. No one, that is, except you. You are due to go to base hospital on the next convoy of ambulances, but they won't be here before this evening. I know it's a lot to ask of a wounded man, but you can see how desperate I am. The farmer down below has several carts, and I should imagine all the harnesses you would need. What do you say, Herr Hauptmann? Can you help me?
The bandaged officer limped back towards us and stroked our noses tenderly. Then he smiled and nodded.
Very well. It's a sacrilege, Doctor, a sacrilege, he said. But if it's got to be done, then I would rather do it myself and see it is done properly.
So that same afternoon, after our capture, Topthorn and I were hitched up side by side to an old hay cart, and with the officer directing two orderlies, we were driven up through the woods, back towards the thunder of the gunfire and the wounded that awaited us. Topthorn was all the time in a great state of alarm, for it was clear he had never pulled before in his life, and at last I was able in my turn to help him, to lead, to compensate, and to reassure him. The officer led us at first, limping along beside me with his stick, but he was soon confident enough to mount the cart with the two orderlies and take the reins.
"You've done a bit of this before, my friend," he said. "I can tell that. I always knew the British for mad. Now I know that they use horses such as you as cart horses. I am quite sure of it. That's what this war is all about, my friend. It's about which of us is the madder. And clearly you British started with an advantage. You were mad beforehand."
All that afternoon and evening, while the battle raged, we trudged up to the lines, loaded up with the stretcher cases, and brought them back to the field hospital. It was several miles each way over roads and tracks filled with shell holes and littered with the corpses of mules and men. The artillery barrage from both sides was continuous. It roared overhead all day as the armies hurled their men at each other across no man's land, and the wounded that could walk poured back along the roads. I had seen the same grey faces looking out from under their helmets somewhere before. All that was different were the uniforms. They were grey now with red piping, and the helmets were no longer round with a broad brim. It was almost night before the tall officer left us, waving goodbye to us and to the doctor from the back of the ambulance as it bumped its way across the field and out of sight. The doctor turned to the orderlies who had been with us all day.
"See to it that they are well cared for, these two," he said. "They saved good lives today, these two. Good German lives and good English lives. They deserve the best of care. See to it that they have it."
For the first time that night since we came to the war, Topthorn and I had the luxury of a stable. The shed in the farm that lay across the fields from the hospital was emptied of pigs and poultry, and we were led in to find a rack brimming full with sweet hay and buckets of soothing cold water. That night after we had finished our hay, Topthorn and I were lying down together at the back of the shed. I was half awake and could think only of my aching muscles and sore feet. Suddenly the door creaked open, and the stable filled with a flickering orange light. Behind the light there were footsteps. We looked up, and I was seized at that moment with a kind of panic. For a fleeting moment I imagined myself back at home in the stable with old Zoe. The dancing light triggered off an alarm in me, reminding me at once of Albert's father. I was on my feet in an instant and backing away from the light with Topthorn beside me, protecting me. However, when the voice spoke, it was not the rasping, drunken voice of Albert's father, but rather a soft, gentle tone of a girl's voice, a young girl. I could see now that there were two people behind the light, an old man, a bent old man in rough clothes and clogs, and beside him stood a young girl, her head and shoulders wrapped in a shawl.
"There you are, Grandpapa," she said. "I told you they put them in here. Have you ever seen anything so beautiful? Oh, can they be mine, Grandpapa? Please, can they be mine?"
Chapter 10. If it is possible to be happy in the middle of a nightmare, then Topthorn and I were happy that summer.
Every day we had to make the same hazardous journeys up to the front line, which, in spite of almost continuous offensives and counter-offensives, moved only a matter of a few hundred yards in either direction. Hauling our ambulance cart of dying and wounded back from the trenches, we became a familiar sight along the pitted track. More than once we were cheered by marching soldiers as they passed us. Once, after we had plodded on, too tired to be fearful, through a devastating barrage that straddled the road in front of us and behind us, one of the soldiers with his tunic covered in blood and mud came and stood by my head and threw his good arm around my neck and kissed me.
"Thank you, my friend," he said. "I never thought they would get us out of that hellhole. I found this yesterday and thought about keeping it for myself, but I know where it belongs."
And he reached up and hung a muddied ribbon around my neck. There was an iron cross dangling on the end of it.
"You'll have to share it with your friend," he said. "They tell me you're both English. I bet you are the first English in this war to win an iron cross, and the last, I shouldn't wonder."
The waiting wounded outside the hospital tent clapped and cheered us to the echo, bringing doctors, nurses and patients running out of the tent to see what there could be to clap about in the midst of all this misery. They hung our iron cross on a nail outside our stable door, and on the rare quiet days when the shelling stopped and we were not needed to make the journey up to the front, a few of the walking wounded would wander down from the hospital to the farmyard to visit us. I was puzzled by this adulation, but loved it, thrusting my head over the high stable door whenever I heard them coming into the yard. Side by side, Topthorne and I would stand at the door to receive our unlimited ration of compliments and adoration, and of course this was sometimes accompanied by a welcome gift of perhaps a lump of sugar or an apple. But it was the evenings of that summer that stay so strong in my memory. Often it would not be until dusk that we would clatter into the yard, and there, always waiting by the stable door, would be the little girl and her grandfather who had come to us that first evening. The orderlies simply handed us over into their charge, and that was just as well, for, kind as they were, they had no notion about horses. It was little Emily and her grandfather who insisted that they should look after us. They rubbed us down and saw to our sores and bruises. They fed us, watered us, and groomed us, and somehow always found enough straw for a dry, warm bed. Emily made us each a fringe to tie over our eyes to keep the flies from bothering us, and in the warm summer evenings, she would lead us out to graze in the meadow below the farmhouse and stayed with us, watching us grazing until her grandfather called us in again. She was a tiny, frail creature, but led us about the farm with complete confidence, chatting all the while about what she'd been doing all the day and about how brave we were and how proud she was of us. As winter came on again and the grass lost its flavour and goodness, she would climb up into the loft above the stable and throw down our hay for us, and she would lie down on the loft floor looking at us through the trapdoor while we pulled the hay from the rack and ate it. Then, with her grandfather busying himself about us, she would prattle on merrily about how when she was older and stronger and when the soldiers had all gone home and the war was over, she would ride us herself through the woods, one at a time, she said, and how we would never want for anything if only we would stay with her forever. Topthorne and I were, by now, seasoned campaigners, and it may well have been that that drove us on out through the roar of the shell fire back towards the trenches each morning. But there was more to it than that. For us it was the hope that we would be back that evening in our stable and that little Emily would be there to comfort and to love us. We had that to look forward to and to long for. Any horse has an instinctive fondness for children, for they speak more softly and their size precludes any threat. But Emily was a special child for us, for she spent every minute she could with us and lavished us with her affection. She would be up late every evening with us, rubbing us down and seeing to our feet, and be up again at dawn to see us fed properly before the orderlies led us away and hitched us up to the ambulance cart. She would climb the wall by the pond and stand there waving, and although I could never turn round, I knew she would stay there until the road took us out of sight. And then she would be there when we came back in the evening, clasping her hands in excitement as she watched us being unhitched. But one evening, at the onset of winter, she was not there to greet us as usual. We had been worked even harder that day than usual, for the first snows of winter had blocked the road up to the trenches to all but the horse-drawn vehicles, and we had to make twice the number of trips to bring in the wounded. Exhausted, hungry and thirsty, we were led into our stable by Emily's grandfather, who said not a word, but saw to us quickly before hurrying back across the yard to the house. Topthorn and I spent that evening by the stable door, watching the gentle fall of snow and the flickering light in the farmhouse. We knew something was wrong before the old man came back and told us. He came late at night, his feet crumping the snow. He had made up the buckets of hot mash we had come to expect, and he sat down on the straw beneath the lantern and watched us eat.
"She prays for you," he said, nodding slowly. "Do you know, every night before she goes to bed, she prays for you. I've heard her. She prays for her dead father and mother. They were killed only a week after the war began. One shell, that's all it takes. And she prays for her brother that she'll never see again. Just 17, and he doesn't even have a grave. It's as if he never lived except in our minds. Then she prays for me, and for the war to pass by the farm and to leave us alone. And last of all, she prays for you too. She prays for two things. First, that you both survive the war and live on into ripe old age. And secondly, that if you do, she dearly wants to be there to be with you. She's barely 13, my Emily, and now she's lying up there in her room, and I don't know if she'll live to see the morning. The German doctor from the hospital tells me it's pneumonia. He's a good enough doctor, even if he is German. He's done his best. It's up to God now. And so far, God hasn't done too well for my family. If she goes, if my Emily dies, then the only light left in my life will be put out.
He looked up at us through heavily wrinkled eyes and wiped the tears from his face.
If you can understand anything of what I said, then pray for her to whatever horse God you pray to. Pray for her like she does for you.
There was heavy shelling all that night, and before dawn the next day the orderlies came for us and led us out into the snow to be hitched up. There was no sign of Emily nor her grandfather. Pulling the cart through the fresh, uncut snow that morning, Topthorn and I needed all our strength just to haul the empty cart up to the front line. The snow disguised perfectly the ruts and shell holes, so that we found ourselves straining to extricate ourselves from the piled-up snow and the sinking mud beneath it. We made it to the front line, but only with the help of the two orderlies who jumped out whenever we were in difficulties and turned the wheels over by hand until we were free again and the cart could gather momentum through the snow once more. The field dressing station behind the front line was crowded with wounded, and we had to bring back a heavier load than we ever had before, but fortunately the way back was mostly downhill. Someone suddenly remembered it was Christmas morning, and they sang slow, tuneful carols all the way back. For the most part, they were casualties blinded by gas, and in their pain some of them cried as they sang for their lost sight. We made so many journeys that day and stopped only when the hospital could take no more. It was already a starry night by the time we reached the farm. The shelling had stopped, there were no flares to light up the sky and blot out the stars. All the way along the lane, not a gun fired. Peace had come for one night. One at least. The snow in the yard was crisped by the frost. There was a dancing light in our stable, and Emily's grandfather came out into the snow and took our reins from the orderly.
"It's a fine night," he said to us as he led us in. "It's a fine night, and all's well. There's mash and hay and water in there for you. I've given you extra tonight, but not because it's cold, but because you prayed. You must have prayed to that horse god of yours, because my Emily woke up at lunchtime. Sat up she did, and do you know the first thing she said? I'll tell you. She said, 'I must get up. Got to get their mash ready for them when they come back. They'll be cold and tired,' she said. The only way that German doctor could get her to stay in bed was to promise you extra rations tonight. And she made him promise to go on with them as long as the cold weather lasted. So, go inside, my beauties, and eat your fill. We've all had a Christmas present today, haven't we? All's well, I tell you. All's well."
Chapter 11. And all was to stay well for a time at least. For the war suddenly moved away from us that spring. We knew it was not over, for we could still hear distant thunder of the guns, and the troops came marching through the farmyard from time to time up towards the line. But there were fewer wounded now to bring in, and we were needed less and less to pull our ambulance cart back and forth from the trenches. Topthorn and I were put out to grass in the meadow by the pond most days, but the evenings were still cold with the occasional frost, and our Emily would always come to get us in before dark. She did not need to lead us. She had but to call and we followed. Emily was still weak from her illness and coughed a great deal as she fussed around us in the stable. From time to time now she would heave herself up onto my back and I would walk so gently around the yard and out into the meadow with Topthorn following close behind. She used no reins on me, no saddle, no bits, no spurs, and sat astride me not as my mistress, but rather as a friend. Topthorn was just that much taller and broader than me, and she found it very difficult to mount him and even more difficult to get down. Sometimes she would use me as a stepping stone to Topthorn, but it was a difficult manoeuvre for her, and more than once she fell off in the attempt. But between Topthorn and me there was never any jealousy, and he was quite content to plod around beside us and take her on board whenever she felt like it. One evening we were out in the meadow, sheltering under the chestnut tree from the heat of the new summer sun, when we heard the sound of an approaching convoy of lorries coming back from the front. As they came through the farm gate, they called out to us, and we recognised them as the orderlies, nurses and doctors from the field hospital. As the convoy stopped in the yard, we galloped over to the gate by the pond and looked over. Emily and her grandfather emerged from the milking shed and were deep in conversation with the doctor. Quite suddenly we found ourselves besieged by all the orderlies we had come to know so well. They climbed the fence and patted and smoothed us with great affection. They were exuberant, yet somehow sad at the same time. Emily was running over towards us, shouting and screaming.
"I knew it would happen," she said. "I knew it. I prayed for it to happen, and it did happen. They don't need you anymore to pull their cards. They're moving the hospital further up along the valley. There's a big, big battle going on up there, and so they're moving away from us. But they don't want to take you with them. That kind doctor has told Grandpapa that you can both stay. It's a kind of payment for the card they used and the food they took, and because we looked after you throughout all the winter. He says you can stay and work on the farm until the army needs you again. And they never will. And if they ever did, I'd hide you. We'll never let them take you away, will we, Grandpapa? Never, never."
And so, after the long, sad farewells, the convoy moved away up the road in a cloud of dust, and we were left alone in peace with Emily and her grandfather. The peace was to prove sweet, but short-lived. To my great delight, I found myself once more a farm horse. With Topthorn harnessed up beside me, we set to work the very next day, cutting and turning the hay. When Emily protested after that first long day in the fields that her grandfather was working us too hard, he put his hands on her shoulders and said,
"Nonsense, Emily. They like to work. They need to work. And besides, the only way for us to go on living, Emily, is to go on like we did before. The soldiers have gone now, so if we pretend hard enough, then maybe the war will go away altogether. We must live as we have always lived, cutting our hay, picking our apples and tilling our soil. We cannot live as if there will be no tomorrow. We can live only if we eat, and our food comes from the land. We must work the land if we want to live, and these two must work it with us. They don't mind. They like the work. Look at them, Emily. Do they look unhappy?"
For Topthorn, the transition from pulling an ambulance cart to pulling a hay turner was not a difficult one, and he adapted easily. And for me, it was a dream I had dreamed many times since I had left the farm in Devon. I was working once more with happy, laughing people around me who cared for me. We pulled with a will that harvest, Topthorn and I, hauling in the heavy hay wagons to the barns where Emily and her grandfather would unload. And Emily continued to watch over us lovingly. Every scratch and bruise was tended to at once, and her grandfather was never allowed to work us for too long, however much he argued. But the return to the peaceful life of a farm horse could not last long, not in the middle of that war. The hay was almost all gathered in when the soldiers came back again one evening. We were in our stables when we heard the sound of approaching hoofbeats and the rumbling of wheels on the cobblestones as the column came trotting into the yard. The horses, six at a time, were yoked to great heavy guns, and they stood in their traces, puffing and blowing with exertion. Each pair was ridden by men whose faces were severe and hard under their grey caps. I noticed at once that these were not the gentle orderlies that had left us only a few short weeks before.
Their faces were strange and harsh, and there was a new alarm and urgency in their eyes. Few of them seemed to laugh or even smile. These were a different breed of men from those we had seen before. Only one old soldier who drove the ammunition cart came over to stroke us and spoke kindly to little Emily. After a brief consultation with Emily's grandfather, the artillery troop bivouacked in our meadow that night, watering the horses in our pond. Topthorn and I were excited by the arrival of new horses and spent all evening with our heads over the stable door, neighing to them, but most of them seemed too tired to reply. Emily came to tell us about the soldiers that evening, and we could see she was worried, for she would talk only a whisper.
"Grandpapa doesn't like them here," she said. "He doesn't trust the officer. Says he's got eyes like a wasp, and you can't trust a wasp. But they'll be gone in the morning, and then we'll be on our own again."
Early that next morning, as the dark of night left the sky, a visitor came to our stables. It was a pale, thin man in dusty uniform who peered over the door to inspect us. He had eyes that stood out of his face in a permanent stare, and he wore a pair of wire-framed spectacles through which he watched us intently, nodding as he did so. He stood a few minutes and then left. By full light, the artillery troop was drawn up in the yard and ready to move. There was a loud and incessant knocking on the farmhouse door, and we saw Emily and her grandfather come out into the yard still dressed in their nightclothes.
"Your horses, monsieur," the bespectacled officer announced baldly. "I shall be taking your horses with us. I have one team with only 4 horses, and I need 2 more. They look fine, strong animals, and they will learn quickly. We will be taking them with us."
"But how can I work my farm without horses?" Emily's grandfather said. "They are just farm horses. They won't be able to pull guns."
"Sir," said the officer, "there is a war on, and I have to have horses for my guns. I have to take them. What you do on your farm is your own business, but I must have the horses. The army needs them."
"But you can't," Emily cried.
"They're my horses. You can't take them. Don't let them, Grandpapa. Don't let them. Please don't let them."
The old man shrugged his shoulders sadly.
"My child," he said quietly, "what can I do?"